The following is an encore presentation of the World Vision Report.
This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. Join us today for stories about the world's most vulnerable people and those who make a difference in their lives. On this week's show, we meet the man who's fighting forced marriages in Great Britain.
A mother and a father might force their 18-year-old daughter to marry somebody from Pakistan because she has started drinking alcohol or she is dating a white guy.
And help wanted. Strawberry farmers in Spain recruit mothers from Morocco. Plus, going nowhere in Chad.
Three women on mules rode by, laughing. They knew that for the amount of money I paid for my 4x4, I could have bought a dozen mules and rode one of them to the camp in 30 minutes.
Welcome to the World Vision Report. In England, the problem of forced marriage is not uncommon in the large immigrant population from Pakistan and Bangladesh. It happens often enough that the British government has set up a special unit to tackle forced marriage. We invited the head of that unit onto the show to talk about his work. Peter Abbott, welcome to the World Vision Report.
Yeah, it's a pleasure.
How does your office define forced marriage as opposed to, say, an arranged marriage? How do you know it's a forced marriage?
Yeah, you're absolutely right to make that definition, and that is central to the work that we do. The definition that we go by is where the consent is missing. There's also a second element to that. There may also be duress. That's either emotional duress or physical duress. Oftentimes it's both.
How often does this really happen in England, and who's doing this?
Well, it's very hard to say really how often it happens. Forced marriage is an aspect of a wider phenomenon that we call honour crimes, or so-called honour crimes. And because elements of honour and shame are involved, it's a very underreported phenomenon. The forced marriage unit, though, handles approximately 300 cases of forced marriage every year and receives about 5,000 inquiries. But we're just one unit dealing with this. There are other non-governmental organisations, refuges, women's organisations, who handle cases of forced marriage every day like we do. So I would say the 300 cases a year that we deal with is just the very tip of the iceberg.
And these are 300 in Great Britain, or British citizens?
Yeah, we only handle cases of British citizens who are forced into marriage, but those can be overseas or in the UK.
Which groups of people in England are more likely to be engaged in these kind of honour crimes?
About 65% of our cases originate in families of Pakistani origin. 25% of our cases originate in families of Bangladeshi origin. So it's fairly clear from those statistics that the majority of forced marriage cases are happening in specific communities. Now, I should say, we've seen cases from across the world. You know, we've seen cases in Ireland, for example, in Spain, in Turkey, all across the world, even in North America.
Can you explain the phenomenon of forced marriage? What is the thinking behind this? You called it an honor crime. Why is it an honor crime? And what is forced marriage all about?
I'm speaking slightly hypothetically here when I say that there are many different reasons why forced marriages happen. The overwhelming reason, though, is to correct behavior that parents see their children entering into, behavior that they might associate with becoming too westernized. So, for example, a mother and a father might force their 18-year-old daughter to marry somebody from Pakistan because she has started drinking alcohol, or she is dating a white guy. Or for another very, very difficult example is if she is gay, for example. So really, forced marriage is seen, I think, as a kind of an antidote, if you will, to overtly westernized young people.
And how do you force an 18-year-old to marry someone? I mean, I've got these images of dragging someone down an aisle. I mean, can't these young people refuse to marry who their parents have chosen for them?
Yes, of course they can refuse. But what I think it's very hard for us to understand is quite the level of emotional blackmail and emotional duress that is being put upon these young people. They often come from communities which are so much more close-knit than perhaps other communities that we might be familiar with, that the emotional pressure is not just coming from the parents, but it's coming from everybody they see as they walk down the street. And also, you've got to remember that a lot of these cases happen overseas. So if a young 17-year-old Pakistani boy is taken off to Pakistan, he will find himself in a village as unfamiliar as it would be to either you or I. He might not know how to get out of the village and how to get to the capital city to find assistance. So they're really, really very isolated, both in emotional terms and in physical terms very often.
So all of these kids are British citizens, but if they drag a boy to Pakistan, to a village where he doesn't even speak the language, and force him to marry who the family has chosen, how do you, as a British unit, get involved? That must be pretty difficult.
It is difficult, and sometimes it's the most challenging part of our job. And occasionally we do feel slightly like a sort of cross between a private detective and a special agent. But you know, oftentimes I've said they're very isolated, and they are isolated. But young people will have friends, and they will have spoken to people, and they might have spoken to a teacher or a friend of theirs at school, or if they're particularly concerned about the situation they're going into before they leave the UK, they might contact the police, or they might contact our unit before they leave.
And then you send somebody over to rescue them or stop the wedding?
No, we have what we have is sort of teams of experts, basically based in the high commissions or our embassies in these countries, who are expert in providing assistance to British nationals in trouble. But in those countries, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and India, they have a particular expertise in rescuing victims of forced marriage. So if it becomes necessary, they will travel to that village, speak to the victim herself or himself, and find out whether they actually want to be rescued and repatriated back to the UK.
And if they say yes, they want to be rescued, how do you actually carry out such a rescue?
Well, if they want to come back with us, we always travel out with a local police escort for protection. And if they want to return with us, then they can. We will escort them back to, in the case of Pakistan, escort them back to Islamabad, where we work very closely with a women's refuge to provide safe accommodation. The refuge is fantastic, actually, I should say. I was there a couple of months ago, and they provide medical support. There's also a resident psychiatrist who can provide mental counselling, and they will stay there for approximately two or three nights until we can arrange for them to fly back to the UK.
On your website, there's a story of a girl whose family beat her when she didn't do what they wanted her to do regarding marriage. How does your unit respond to cases like that?
Well, unfortunately, we have to respond every day to cases involving physical abuse, rape, threats of intense violence. We are provided with the same kind of consular training to deal with violent situations that is given to all our consular staff in the UK and in our embassies overseas. But we work very closely with colleagues in the police, in social services, and in women's groups nationwide. So we've got a vast network of support that we can fall back on, that can also provide assistance to girls and men who are going through very, very serious situations indeed.
Do you have a success story, a recent one that you'd like to share with us?
We have success stories all the time. I helped a young girl, for example, and she called me up recently to say that she had just got her driving license. She had changed her name after surviving a forced marriage. She'd changed her name. She'd passed her driving test, and her driving license had her new name on it. And she called me up, and she was absolutely thrilled, because the ability to drive a car, as you know, is a real sign of freedom. And the ability to have her driving license with her new name on it was a real symbol for her of the new life that she had just embarked upon. So it's absolutely wonderful to hear those stories.
Peter Abbott, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
It's an absolute pleasure.
Peter Abbott is the director of the UK's Forced Marriage Unit. He spoke to us from a BBC studio in London. Now, another story about the influence of family and the strength of family ties. For this, we go to Spain, where farm work is abundant, but wages are low. So low that the majority of the farming jobs are filled by immigrants, many of them in the country illegally. Now the Spanish government has set up its own version of a guest worker program, but there's a twist. Daniela Gerson has more from Cartaya in southern Spain.
Nuria El-Bakari likes to sing as she picks strawberries. Even after 6 back-breaking hours in the fields, her voice rings melodically as she plucks berry after berry. What crooked teeth the 45-year-old has left are rotted mostly black. Despite that, her fellow workers call her Shakira because she sings with the endurance of a pop star. El-Bakari says she sings because she is looking forward to going home, where she left her husband and 2 preteen daughters 3 months ago. But she is quick to add, there's another reason she sings.
Life is better here. I like the work and the other women, and the boss is good to us.
The money also pleases her. In Morocco, El-Bakari picked olives and vegetables, earning just over $5 a day. Here in Spain, she makes roughly 10 times as much and works fewer hours. Still, El-Bakari misses her family.
It's difficult, but what can we do? We have to work for our children. There's not enough money in Morocco.
El-Bakari is one of nearly 5,000 Moroccan women harvesting strawberries this year in southern Spain as part of a new program. 2 years ago, the town of Cartaya began recruiting women from poor rural villages in Morocco. Farmers in this area believe women are gentler with the delicate fruit. Juan Antonio Milan is the mayor of Cartaya.
The profile of the worker is that she is a woman, is of an age that is appropriate to work in the fields, and has agricultural experience.
But getting these women to leave Spain at the end of the harvest season was not so easy. Over the past decade, immigration, both legal and illegal, has boomed in Spain. Along with it has come growing concerns about crime, integration, and costs to public services. So this year, the Spanish government tried something different. It guaranteed employment for the next 3-month season if the women returned home. And the mayor says the farmers added another criteria.
That the women are married and are leaving behind children to guarantee that they will return to their country. So this solved the problem of the lack of a workforce, but in a way, ideal for the city. Otherwise, we would have thousands of workers here who work during the harvest and then the rest of the year are unemployed.
Back on the farm, women chat as they take a midday break. 24-year-old Amina eats a snack of homemade flatbread. Like many of these women, Amina has left her 2 children in the care of her mother. My back is aching, she says, but what's hardest is being far from my children. But, she says, inshallah, God willing, she will return next year. Over and over again, the mothers say the chance to provide more for their children is what drives them to come to Spain. At a neighboring farm, dozens of women stand at the roadside, waiting for a ride to the trailer park where they live for free. The women all seem to have plans for the $50 they earn a day. Build better houses, open businesses. One woman calls out.
It goes to my children so they can study. So they won't be like me, not knowing how to read or write.
Night falls, a dozen or so of the women let loose, banging on pots and pans, strapping bangles around their waists, and belly dancing. El-Bakari, the worker called Shakira by her friends, joins in. Her headscarf off for the day, she enthusiastically claps her hands and steps to the music. At the end of the season, El-Bakari boarded a boat back home to Morocco. Officials reported only 10% of the Moroccan mothers stayed in Spain illegally. They're so pleased, they're planning to double the number of women they hire next year. For the World Vision Report, I'm Daniela Gerson in Cartaya, Spain.
now our globe at a glance. In the developing world, local health clinics and hospitals are staffed by general practitioners and nurses. It's next to impossible, if you live in a remote area, to see a specialist. But in some African countries, that's about to change. The Indian government recently started an aid program linking hospitals in Ethiopia to hospitals with specialists in India. They're connected solely through the internet. Here's how it works. A patient in rural Ethiopia visits his doctor at the local hospital. If that doctor needs advice, he arranges for a consultation with a specialist in India. The Ethiopian doctor puts the patient's x-rays, ultrasounds, and lab results up on the computer screen. Thousands of miles away in India, the same image appears on the specialist's computer screen. Then both doctors, one in India, one in Ethiopia, look at the x-rays together, talk to each other about the patient, the diagnosis, and the best way to treat the problem. The patient benefits from the experience and expertise of the specialist, while the local African doctor learns new and advanced skills. Soon, 20 hospitals in Ethiopia will be linked via internet to specialists in India. And eventually, the project will be rolled out all across Africa, where 23 countries have signed up to be part of the telemedicine revolution. Now, patients can be treated by the best doctors available, regardless of where they live. And that's our globe at a glance. I'm Peggy Wehmeyer, and you're listening to the World Vision Report. Several months ago, a massive earthquake shook Indonesia. It triggered a small tsunami that came ashore on the island of Sumatra. There were casualties and some damage was reported, but it was nothing like the tsunami of 2004. That tsunami devastated large parts of Asia's coast, leaving 250,000 people dead. At the time, it was difficult to imagine how the region would ever recover. But in Banda Aceh, the Indonesian town hit hardest by the tsunami, life is bustling. People have rebuilt their lives and their businesses. Prue Clark takes a look at the comeback of Aceh's rickshaw drivers.
Mukhtar Ali picks up his first customer for the day. A sharp and wiry 47-year-old, Mukhtar plies Aceh's streets, ferrying everyone from housewives to office workers on his bear chuck, a small motorbike with a sidecar that can take as many as three passengers. Before the tsunami, Mukhtar was the chairman of Aceh's 500-member association of bear chuck drivers. After the tsunami, their ranks were halved and just a handful of bear chucks were left. The association has a new office, here at the back of Mukhtar's house. Mukhtar says he was home when the massive earthquake that triggered the wave hit the town.
Suddenly my wife screamed because she saw people running, and then we saw the huge wave coming. I was so scared. I got to my motorbike, I got it started, and my wife and I jumped on the bike and just got ahead of the wave to higher ground.
Mukhtar's brother and mother also reached safety, but another brother and 10 members of his family were washed away. Gone, too, was Mukhtar's modest livelihood.
I had two bear chucks. I kept them in a warehouse and I checked them 16 days after the tsunami, and there was nothing left.
In the months following, the survivors began drifting here to Mukhtar's house to regroup. They applied for aid, and 8 months later, the UN's development program gave them 37 brand new bear chucks. I hop a ride on a bear chuck with Amron Hamdi, who helped coordinate the program for the UNDP. Why was it so important to get these back and up and running?
Well, we identified that bear chuck drivers were some of the most vulnerable group after the tsunami. Bear chuck was the only way to survive. We need the people to continue their lives, not just giving them money and then it's gone. We need to give them something that can be sustainable for their future.
But the UN's aid of 37 Bechaks meant most of the 250 surviving drivers in Aceh would miss out. Back at the association's head office, Mukhtar tells me he and others came up with a plan. Each driver who got a vehicle would pay $1 a day into a fund to buy Bechaks for all of them. That's a lot of money for these drivers, who make about $3 a day. But Mukhtar says the need was great.
Most of our members have lost everything. They lost their houses, their wives, and everything. And they need to get back on with their lives.
The group's been able to buy 50 Bechaks so far. More are on the way. In his office, Mukhtar talks with another driver here to see how long his wait will be for a Bechak. Bechak drivers here are as renowned for dispensing wisdom as their taxi driving comrades elsewhere, and Mukhtar is no exception, as when I expressed surprise at his age.
47? You look too young.
The key to looking young, he tells me, is to feel happy, not to feel angry all the time, and accept your condition as what's been given. Sage advice that reflects the resilience of this community. For the World Vision Report, I'm Prue Clark in Aceh, Indonesia.
Reporter Michael Cavanaugh was in the Central African country of Chad not long ago. He was interviewing refugees from neighboring Darfur who fled the conflict there by the millions. And while it's important for foreign correspondents to get stories from these far-flung places, it's not always easy. Michael sent us this reporter's notebook about a challenge he faced on this trip.
I was on my way to a 9 a.m. meeting at the Gaga refugee camp in eastern Chad. This drive is supposed to take just over an hour, but I gave myself three because, well, this is Chad. There are only about 300 miles of paved roads in the entire country, and it was still the rainy season when a little precipitation can turn a dirt road into a thick soup in minutes. But I'd spent $200 on a driver and a Land Cruiser to avoid this problem, and when we set off, the forecast was clear. Then, about 30 minutes from the camp, the rain began.
This is sound of getting stuck in the mud in Chad on the way to Gaga camp.
By the time I started recording this, we'd been stuck in the mud for 2.5 hours.
Come on.
Technically, French is one of Chad's official languages, along with Arabic. But my driver, Abdullah, spoke as much French as he did English, which is to say, none. And none is exactly how much Arabic I speak. When he picked me up this morning, he'd looked like a sultan, in a flowing ochre robe and a bleached white turban. Once the car got stuck, his robes came off, and he turned into this skinny guy in gym shorts, madly digging before the giant 4x4 sunk too deep into the mud. We grunted at each other. I took off my shirt and started digging beside him. Whenever you think you're out in the middle of nowhere in a place like eastern Chad, it's amazing how quickly someone finds you. Within 10 minutes, a half dozen kids from a nearby village arrived. Since they were all about the age when playing in the mud was still fun, they immediately jumped under the car and started digging.
Pousse! Un, deux, trois.
But the Land Cruiser wouldn't budge.
Not again.
Three women on mules rode by, laughing. They knew that for the amount of money I paid for my 4x4, I could have bought a dozen mules and rode one of them to the camp in 30 minutes. 5 hours later, we were still there, digging away. Finally, around 1 p.m, a worker from the refugee camp happened to pass by on his motorbike. I hopped on the back, covered in mud and looking like a refugee myself, leaving my driver and his gaggle of pint-sized helpers behind. Midway through my last interview at the refugee camp, my translator stopped me. "Isn't that your car?" he asked me in French. And from across the plains, underneath a cloud-filled sky that stretched for miles, came a speeding Land Cruiser. My Land Cruiser. As the car approached, it seemed a slice of sun shone through the clouds, and I laughed. I said one of the few phrases I knew in Arabic. God be praised. The difficulty of reporting from a place mired in poverty and conflict like Chad is that it's actually normal for things not to work. But what's most strange about a place like this is that things still usually work themselves out. Just never the way you planned.
Michael Cavanaugh is a freelance journalist who frequently reports from Africa. And that's our show for today. Be sure to join us again next week. And remember, you can hear us anytime on the web at worldvisionreport.org. You can also sign up for a podcast there. Our radio team includes Beverly Abel, Doug Boyle, Cynthia Graber, and Diane Toomey. I'm Peggy Wehmeyer. Thanks for listening.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization. Oh,